Welcome to the Conflict Tipping Podcast with Dr. Laura May.
Hello and welcome to the Conflict Tipping Podcast from Mediate.com, the podcast to explore social conflict and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Laura May, and today I have with me Dr. Julia Palmiano-Federer. Julia is a senior researcher at the Center for Security Studies at ETH Zurich and a senior fellow at the Negotiation and Conflict Resolution Collaboratory at the Harvard Kennedy School Center for Public Leadership. Her research interests include critical, feminist, and decolonial approaches to inclusive peace processes, unofficial peace dialogues, and the nexus between climate change and conflict. She is the author of NGOs Mediating Peace and co-author of The Power to Protect, which is going to be launched today as we're recording, of numerous journal articles and policy papers, and laureate of the 2022 Women, Peace, and Security Research Awards. She is also a parent to two children and a wonderful human being. So welcome, Julia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
I am so happy to have you here, especially because as we're recording, it's International Women's Day, and it's great to have two women here talking about peace building and talking about your new book. So I'm very excited to hear about this.
Me too.
First thing first, what led you to this? The biggest question, but what led you to this field of research? What was your interest in peace building?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I'm going to tell my life story a little bit. I was born in Manila in the Philippines, and shortly after my family had immigrated to Vancouver, so the city of Vancouver, located on the unceded Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, in what we call Turtle Island, the indigenous word for North America. And I grew up there, and I ended up moving and a wonderful childhood, really in the Filipino diaspora community there. And I grew up and ended up in Geneva, finding myself in Geneva, doing my master's in international affairs, being first introduced and integrated into research in the policy world, which was really exciting. I was just asking myself, where are the women in all these rooms? And so it really led me down this amazing path of looking at the role of women and gender in peace negotiations and mediation. And then soon after, I ended up having the opportunity to be involved supporting peace processes in different places, and specifically the one at the time that was ongoing in the country of Myanmar, in some places known as Burma, which at the time, which was about 2011, 2015, were undergoing a really incredible transition process to maybe signing a peace agreement that would end almost 60, 70 years of conflict between the government and the army and more than 20 different armed groups. And so this was a very big deal. And at the time, you also had an incredible amount of women civil society organizations all wanting to get involved in the negotiations. And so part of our work was supporting them to do that. Fast forward a few years, while there were a lot of successes, there was also a lot that I felt like I saw, I experienced, I was part of intentionally, unintentionally, that I felt like I needed to critique in some way, which is ended up why I ended up writing a PhD, doing research that asks critical questions about the sort of architecture of international peace building and how actors such as non-governmental organizations, individuals, private actors, the UN, all these sorts of actors enter into a country and support a process, but also promote a certain idea of what a peace process should be, what a society should look like if and when it becomes peaceful. So that's kind of what brought me to this field. And then I think, you know, on a roundabout way, going into a full circle, which is why I talked about my life story, I also was really inspired and kind of struck by this idea of going over there or to other places and not looking at conflicts or my community or how I grew up. And so I had the opportunity to start working with some incredible colleagues. One of them is my incredible co-author, looking at this idea of conflict and locating Canada as a site of conflict and how Indigenous women, non-Indigenous women, were working together to sort of mitigate conflict. And it's kind of a different way of how I was taught conflict was and what it looked like. And so that's been really inspiring in my work. So that's a bit of a roundabout way of saying I came back home. And then home, I'm trying to go a step further in understanding, well, why did I go into conflict resolution? I think also to heal conflict within myself as a researcher, as a peace building practitioner, as someone that was removed from her home because of politics and conflicts that were happening in a certain way, and growing up in diaspora and not having that maybe ancestral knowledge or community connection. And I learned, and maybe I'll end this with a story of working with some colleagues, and you know, they ask you, why are you doing this? Like, what's your purpose? And why are you in this field? And what came out was I was trying to heal myself. And she's like, you know what? A lot of people that go into conflict resolution and mediation and negotiation are doing it to heal themselves. And I'm pretty convinced of that. So I think it's all connected. And I feel pretty strongly about that. So I hope that answers your question in a very circular way.
I mean, to be fair, I asked you the broadest question in the world. So yeah. Whatever you gave me would have been an answer at this point. But certainly what you've said just now in terms of healing others to heal yourself, yeah, this is something I've heard really a lot with conflict researchers and mediators. Mm-hmm. Well, also therapists, I would say, this comes up quite a lot. And they're like, well, I can't fix what's happening in here. Let me externalize this. Let me fix the problems around me. And that will fix whatever conflict I can't quite deal with internally, or I have no control to deal with internally. So I really admire that this is something you recognize about yourself.
Because I guess I mean, it took me like 15 years
But no, that's incredible. And I mean, it makes me wonder if it's not, maybe it is too personal. Like how will you know that you have resolved the conflicts in the world that you need to tell you?
Ooh, yeah, we're going there. It's
straight in.
Straight in. Oh, I love it. And I feel like that's where I wanted to go, because it was something that I've learned as a woman of color researcher that I self-identify as, being in a field of academic research and practice in international peace mediation, as you might understand, is maybe there are not a lot of people who identify in this kind of way in leadership positions, putting scholarship out there, et cetera. And so how would I know? I think if it's communities directly around me, so I would be talking about, let's say if I'm have a community of other peacebuilding researchers, academics, scholar activists that I would also put myself into the community with, and then also where I work. So in Turtle Island in Canada, but also in Southeast Asia, in Myanmar, in the Philippines, that I don't get that sort of, there's two things. Getting that sort of unsettled feeling of just like ethical ickiness of something is not right and something could be done better or in a better way. But then also, which I've also learned working with Indigenous colleagues that I've had so many teachings from in the last few years, that the ick is also a good sign that you are unsettling yourself and unlearning and questioning things that were meant to not be questioned. And then I think finding people that think the same way as me, so I know it's not just me like shouting into the void, and finding community in that way, I feel like that's when I'll know stuff is happening. And then also, yeah, how it shows up in my own personal life, because I feel like that's all also connected as a researcher, as an academic, as a scholar, as a practitioner, as a parent, as a peace builder. Yeah. Yeah, we went there, huh?
We did. We went straight there. Like, I should have warned you. It's like, this is going to come with vulnerability today. You
know, that's good. Like, that's awesome. No.
Yeah. Now, I find that really interesting. And I want to dig in a little bit to the ethical ickiness, because I guess this relates to what you were saying before in terms of when you're in the wider world, you notice this difference between how you were taught to look at conflict and then what you've learned more recently or more lastly about what conflict really is or how it's constituted. So, I mean, is that the source of the ethical ickiness? Can you explore that a bit for me?
Yeah, I like how this is a chance. This is the first time I've ever said that, but it's the ethical ick. Yeah, hey, I think this is great that we use ethical ick. We're going to make it a thing, like fetch.
Yep. 100%. Oh my God, not like fetch. Like, we can't have any Mean Girls references.
All right. I realize it's the wrong one. Okay, so ethical ick. Yeah, so I would say that developing the ethical ick was not when I was studying conflict resolution and international affairs in Geneva per se. It's an amazing program, but then it was only being really lucky to be in an institution at the time where I was really spoiled for choice with amazing critical peace researchers. So it was at the University of Basel and at Swiss Peace, where you could really explore questions of knowledge production, like how the knowledge of what mediation is and what it should be, or what peace is and what it should be, is mediated through this very Western Eurocentric lens, and having all of this incredible decolonial feminist critical literature that you just can sort of swim in and be really formed by. But at the same time, that's not going to be in your 100 level syllabi of your undergraduate courses, or even your graduate courses to some extent. And then you end up being put in these silos of critical theorists. There's a, you know, positivist, we work with numbers, we work with data, ideas and stories and things are not real data. These sorts of debates, right, that we see a lot, and that are evergreen in academia and scholarship. And so I think the ethical ick developed in and has been really confirmed by being able to ask questions of who is producing knowledge, what kind of knowledge is being produced, what knowledge is valued and what's not, and then learning in real time by lived experience that often. And now there's research to back this up. My colleague just wrote an incredible article on how mainstream and dominant peace mediation research is produced by white male, or people that identify as male, in Western institutions. And she brings out the data receipts to prove it. And so I think having that sort of knowledge production piece helps me understand, okay, when is it not feeling right? And it's almost an embodied feeling. Like, there were many instances doing field research as like a, I was under 35 at the time, working with peace process actors, doing interviews and doing my best to have it done in an ethical way, but still really asking hard questions of like, well, what am I doing here and why? And what was it that made me work on Myanmar as a case study versus other Burmese researchers that, you know, what's their access to knowledge, to journals versus mine? So a lot of these questions of, I'm going to use this word in quotes because it might be jargony, but positionality, like, where is my identity? What's my position to power? And how does that affect what I'm writing about, but even how I ask questions? And so I think being able to develop that muscle and reflex, which is still very contentious, like for some researchers, and there's big hardcore academic debates that are debating whether you should bring in your own position and your values but into research. But it's like, for me, it's an obvious, you cannot separate this. This is an artificial separation. So I feel like navigating those really difficult questions is always really a part of that. And then tapping into that ick. If I feel an ick about something, then I channel it by writing a critical piece about it. And I think, yeah, that's how I'm working.
Okay. So I am just going to do some de-jargoning for a moment for those.
No. Who Sorry, it's a lot of jargoning.
No, that's fine. And so if I can summarize, a core concern here is that when people do learn about peace building or conflict, you know, they go to university and it's all there in the numbers. And it's like, this is the process. This is what you follow. Put in A plus B at the start, it ends up at peace at the end. And that's a sort of like mathematical in this way, right? But then as you go on through your studies, you start to have access to other ideas and other processes and go, well, actually, there's these people over here that have great ideas and great processes. Like, why are we ignoring them? Or why are they excluded in the process? Or why aren't we talking about their work? And then in your own professional career, you know, you went and you started with this and you noticed that you were there as a researcher who had the privilege of the access to this kind of education and to these kinds of journals. And there were people from the same location who didn't have the same access and maybe weren't able to shape the process or express for what they needed or how they saw their future should be. And that in some ways was the source of the ick.
100%. Yes, that's right. A very good de-jargoning summary of it. Yeah, I think it's a guiding feeling for me that influences a lot of my writing and work. So whether it's this idea of who's mediating and what is being mediated in a certain peace process of, yeah, asking just these questions running in the back of my head of access to power. So who am I as a researcher? What am I bringing with me? What's my political baggage? What's my lived experience? What's my privilege? And then how is that influencing what I'm writing, who I'm speaking to? And then am I doing harm by conducting this research? am I really making a contribution to that place? And what is the point? Like, what is really, is it for me? Or is it for the context? Is it for us as like a community of mediation researchers and practitioners? And so I don't think it should be paralyzing. I think it's just having more awareness about it.
Having those different lenses to look at things. But what I really love as well is that you mentioned that the ick is embodied. You feel it, right? Because I mean, often I love that we're using the ick. I love this. So
I know. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. Because the thing is, I mean, often people will say they'll get the ick from going on a date, right? And they're like, oh, I just had the ick. So there's something not quite right there. And it's that discomfort. And then I think part of maybe it's emotional maturation in some way, right? Mm-hmm. Is starting to listen to that ick and to that feeling and go, oh, like my body's telling me that there's something here that is not quite right for me. It doesn't sit well. And then in the academic context, we're able to use that and say, oh, okay, what is this conflict that I have inside of me? What can I do about it? And what do I need to listen to here? So I love that you've actually mentioned it's embodied, because it's the ick. I love it. I love it so much.
Oh my God. Me too. I'm kind of obsessed with it. Yeah.
Awesome. So I understand that your first book was actually about this ick, but more of your experiences, mm-hmm. right? So this your book, NGOs Mediating Peace.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, how did you do the research and what did you find? Like, what was the takeaway?
Yeah, thanks. So this book, it took 8 years of research. It came out of my doctoral work, and it really was born out of being a practitioner and working on supporting civil society organizations, so community organizations in Myanmar at the time of negotiations, work on this idea of inclusive peace. And so this very big idea in peace mediation circles today, both academic, both practitioner circles, that inclusive peace is incredibly important and is not just a nice to have. It's absolutely necessary if you want to have peace agreements be legitimate, sustainable, mm-hmm. implementable. And I'm very much interested in this idea. A lot of my research is about norms in mediation. And there are three of us on a research team, and we all looked at the idea of norms in mediation and how they're being promoted. And if we think of what's a norm, we think about it as a social norm of things that ought to be, things that should be, rather than what things actually are. So, you know,
an example might be neutrality.
Norm of neutrality, or their gender inequality. So there's peace processes should be more inclusive. Mediation processes should have more women or youth, religious leaders, etc. So this inclusive peace norm is this holy grail idea of what your peace process should be. And my book is really about how international mediation, I would say and argue, along with other colleagues, has really changed, where it isn't about two white men in suits flying in and hammering out, brokering a ceasefire agreement. It's evolved to become something much more about redefining a society, that this is this opportunity a society has to have this rupture and then redefine itself. Women are more included. Women have more rights. And it's a massive debate of whether mediation processes should be the site of these big societal questions at all. And so that's a little bit what I take up in this book. The book is really about how NGOs, so non-governmental organizations that have really evolved to become professionalized mediation actors. And this has been a trend that's only, we've seen this only develop in the last 20 or 30 years with organizations such as the Swiss Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, the Finnish Crisis Management Initiative, and then others from around the world now really developing, really going into a country that's experiencing conflict and working directly with the negotiating parties, whether that's government actors or often they are armed resistance, or some people say rebel organizations. And that's really new, because you used to really have formal peace mediation being defined by a high-level diplomat. And that's still very much the case. But then there are all these other new actors that have entered onto the field. And I have a chapter really talking about calling NGO mediators cowboys or mavericks, because the jury is still a little bit out on what these groups bring to bear on a process. Are they really mavericks that are redefining the field, bringing in new practices that are getting things done, basically when really formal processes are stuck? or a group is maybe, let's say, listed as a terrorist organization, so you can't have dialogue with them. Mm-hmm. They would take it upon themselves to go in and prepare the ground for maybe negotiations so that when the time is better or more politically palatable, it's possible. Anyways, then there's a whole other part of this debate that's saying they're just cowboys. They don't care about political parameters, international law. They're just kind of doing whatever. And it's talking with rebel groups and making everything a lot more messy. And we need to coordinate this. So it's really interesting. I'm like a fly on the wall framing the debate and sort of loving it. So that's what I talk about in the book. But NGOs also have this other really important piece about them, that they are not totally separate from civil society organizations, but they're also producers of knowledge. And we're coming back to this knowledge question of what mediation should or shouldn't be. And so you have these NGOs working with the conflict parties, convening them in back rooms, et cetera, of what we envision mediation is, but also writing handbooks, policy briefs, guidances about women's inclusion or civil society inclusion, or creating a peace agreement that also has transitional justice mechanisms, which is dealing with questions and really thorny questions of justice. So all of this to say that it's incredibly interesting, but there's also a very big risk of when NGOs come into a place and promote norms, which per se are extremely important, right? Gender equality. I'm not arguing that a norm like gender equality and women's inclusion is bad, and I'm putting that in air quotes. It's that these perceptions or this idea of what inclusion is isn't really connecting, or I think, in my opinion, acknowledging what gender and inclusion already means in the Myanmar context, which I write about in the book. And I think this is the decolonial critique that other decolonial authors have made. It's like it's a so-called universal norm that I think needs to be mediated and needs to be connected to the ideas, the narratives, beliefs, the community structures that are already there and not just imposed or transposed in this beautiful and important package. So that's what the book is a little bit about in that way. And it came out of this idea that I was observing there, and it was just this relentless promotion of women's inclusion, which was really important, and the women was taking it up. But in what way, in what modalities, and when were these training workshops? When were these knowledge products? When was this research actually integrating with Burmese language, with Burmese cosmologies, with Theravada Buddhism, which was a huge element of the life and culture and life ways of that community? So that's in the book. So read the book. This is my shameless plug.
Everyone read the book. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And I mean, I think you really highlighted this challenge of mediation. I'm going to go off country for a moment, because as you were talking, it reminded me of this idea of normative power in Europe, right? Where they're like, oh, the EU is this normative power, it spreads norms. And so if you want to become a candidate country or whatever, you have to do things along the lines of gender equality, along the lines of like LGBT rights and so on and so forth, even where those norms might not be met within the EU. And so it's treated as a normative power. And I remember actually doing, during my master's research, discourses from Russia, one of our least favorite countries right now, but it had this argument of, well, these are not our norms. You know, we have our own idea of what sovereignty looks like, our own idea of these. And so then bringing that back to sort of the peace context, you can sort of see, well, yeah, like when we go into a country and we say, all right, well, here are the peace process. Yes, we'll be flexible, we'll be inclusive, whatever. But here are some underlying values we're going to be using and we're not going to negotiate on. We can see that it is a norm spreading exercise. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that this mediation then becomes about redefining society. It's not about resolving one problem or two problems or, you know, violence in whatever context. It's like, no, we're going to rebuild. And the norms that have become fundamental, that new society, haven't grown there. They've been imposed and they've been brought in as part of this process. And so it's kind of a socializing thing. And so I understand that's where the decolonializing argument comes from, right? That, you know, you might have the best intentions of the world. And yes, you want people to stop being violent and you want people to be emancipated and what have you, but it's still coming from you. It's being imposed. And it just makes me wonder, I mean, who are the right people to do the right mediation in the right way? Because I don't know. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, that is the question. And that's the question that the book ends on, because there is no answer. So, you know, in the book, I illustrate both the intended consequences of how they promoted this norm. So just saying like how things ended up the way they planned, but also the unintended consequences. In a lot of ways, this peace agreement that was signed in 2015, after all this period of negotiations, notwithstanding the current context under the authoritarian coup that's unfolding right now in Myanmar, but in a lot of ways, it ended up as a more exclusive outcome. And I talk a little bit about why in the book, but, you know, civil society actors ended up becoming crowded out and it overpromised a lot of things. And there were a lot of critiques about it. But then, yeah, then you kind of step back and zoom out a little bit more and you think of, well, should be NGO mediators or mediators in general be promoting norms or not? The book shows that they can. It actually works. Like there's a lot of mechanisms and all this stuff that they can use. But that's the kind of soul-searching, unsettling question that we need to ask ourselves. And I don't have an answer. What I tried to allude to is that I don't think there should be doing away with, you know, international mediation and structures that are needed to address conflict, because we're seeing that now. And it's a way bigger question than the scope of this book and this our conversation today. But I think they're just absolutely needs to be a baseline, better understanding of existing ideas, cultural practices. Historically, you know, like the Myanmar peace process did not start in 2011 when the country opened up after decades of authoritarian rule. And a lot of programming was being designed as if it did. And so a lot of very ahistorical programming and design, I think these are all very achievable things if we all as peace practitioners and researchers start asking ourselves those questions when we're designing programs, designing our research, like again, going back to these it questions of why am I going and why am I designing a peace building inclusive women process in Myanmar right now? Why me? Why my organization? For what purpose? How can it make a contribution? Why is my research in Myanmar right now, or any other country experiencing conflict or any other society? Mm-hmm. And being honest with ourselves, like, why did I choose this as a case versus other places versus somewhere in my own home community? So in terms of the question should, it's like, yes, but with a lot of caveats and a lot more care.
I love that. More caveats and more care. Yeah. It reminds me, because as you know, Juan Diaz was my professor, you know him as well. We both taught his course. And I remember he ended a lecture one time on this idea. He's like, if you want to be a peace mediator or to deal with this kind of conflict, start at home.
Yeah.
You don't need to go somewhere else. And probably that somewhere else doesn't need you. Like, start at home.
100%. There you go. That's the book. Thanks, Juan. And, you know, and listening to his podcast episode, I mean, it's exactly that. It's exactly where I think the field needs to go. And I guess it's a nice segue to my second shameless plug.
I'm so here for this. Yes. Tell me about your new publication.
Yes. It's called The Power to Protect. And it's this report that I co-authored with a dear friend, a dear colleague, Lorelei Higgins Parker. She's a Métis cultural mediator, someone you should definitely have on the podcast at one point. We received this award by the International Development Research Center. So it's a Canadian institution, and they have these awards every year to write about women, peace, and security. And the theme that year was on climate change. And we were thinking of different places that we could write in. And at the time, my work at the University of Ottawa and the Ottawa Dialogue, we had been working for the last 3 years on creating a very small network on Indigenous and non-Indigenous scholars and practitioners located in Turtle Island, which again is the Indigenous term across many Indigenous communities for the space known as North America. So we wanted to come together and discuss different worldviews. So I would say a Western worldview of, let's say, informal mediation, track two diplomacy, these sort of dialogue spaces, whether there was any common ground with Indigenous ways of moving through conflict, which were relevant to the communities that we were working with, which was specifically, and a big part of it, the Mohawk community in Ganawage. So in the end, Lorelei was a part of that network, and that has been super powerful and super formative. I identify as a non-Indigenous settler immigrant, but also as a colonized person coming from the Philippine diaspora. And so there was a lot there. And we were like, why don't we write about Canada and about Turtle Island as a site of conflict? And then we wrote this whole thing about how for many Indigenous communities, conflict is structural. Conflict is, you know, not violent with sort of the dominant images that you see of what conflict is in the world. Yeah. And we won't get into that.
It's not about the bloodshed.
Yeah. It's like structural, latent violence and oppression. And climate change and the climate crisis isn't this future thing. It's here. And for Indigenous communities, it's very much there. And we got the grant. And they had told us it's the first time they funded something on Canada, on Turtle Island, on their own space. Because, you know, it's in their name, it's in their mandate to fund internationally. But it was, you know, we had champions in the institution that were like, no, we need it. We need to change this. We need to look at our own community. So even that was a massive step in kind of undoing these knowledge production structures, these structures that entrench this idea that conflict happens over there and not in our own communities. So then in the end, we basically wrote it to tell a story. And I had never written anything like that. You know, I got my PhD, I did my postdoc, I was trained as a political scientist and qualitative research methods, da, 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 jargon, jargon, jargon. But I had to unlearn everything. And there were parts that were, again, so uncomfortable in terms of, there are so many instances, like the whole design was about engaging with different Indigenous women leading community organizations that were mitigating the effects of climate change in their societies. And we looked in all these different places. We looked in North America and Turtle Island. So we went to Standing Rock. We went where the No Dapple movement was. So this Indigenous-led protest movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline that was really 2016 to 2017, this really widespread protest movement. We were able to speak with women there and we went all sorts of different places. We went along the west coast of Turtle Island to what's known as Vancouver and Seattle today to look at the urban Indigenous experience. And what I wanted to speak about was this process of doing the research. Was we wanted to intentionally create a new way of doing research that was both Indigenous and non-Indigenous and require, let's say there were elements of consent. You're a researcher, you're a peace researcher, you go into a community and you're trained that it is ethical to be able to get informed consent, which is very important. Obviously, it's a basic, it's a minimum. But then when I was with Laura and we were going to go and meet communities, she was like, if you bring this paper as this person you've never seen before and say, sign this, tell me your story, I'm going to go away. Like, what is that? How is that going to build trust? What kind of emotions is that going to bring up? So I basically followed her lead the whole way, doing the research through what I would learn as like a more Indigenous way of knowing and being and doing of showing up, being with the land, making relationships before anything else. But an example of what this research process meant was, what does actually being with the land mean as a non-Indigenous person? I had actually been quite separate from nature and the natural world growing up for a host of different reasons. It meant driving and driving through the Dakotas. It meant driving and being in water, doing water walks, visiting sacred sites, something that just I had never had the opportunity to learn and unlearn. And I think when you talk about what we found, women's agency and Indigenous women's agency is really subtle and it's embodied through care, it's embodied through generational care, it's embodied through community organization, resistance, protest, and all of these themes in international peace mediation literature, in traditional approaches, they're just sort of adjacent and nice to have. So I think that was what we're also trying to do with this research is first locating Canada as a site of conflict, locating Turtle Island as a site of structural oppression. And just because there is not blatant violent aggression and violent political violence doesn't mean it's not there. So that's one piece. And then the second is have a different lens to look at what women are doing, what peace could mean, what climate change means and doesn't mean. So that's what I hope comes out of this report.
I mean, it's really interesting because when you mentioned this report and being in Canada, sort of being about indigeneity and conflict, I guess I was in some way surprised that it was about the structural component, right? And I guess the reason it surprised me is because when I hear about conflict and indigeneity in North America, Turtle Island, as I just learned. So thank you. I think about more obvious violence for sure. Like I think about people who are trafficked or kidnapped or killed without investigation.
Absolutely.
And so I love the nuance you brought here that actually the violence people are experiencing obviously goes beyond that, and it's structural and it's deeply interlinked with land and with climate and with culture and society. So I love that nuance. So thank you for bringing that to my life.
I mean, if I can say, it opens up so many opportunities for us as a field, as a peace mediation field. If we expand our imagination of what conflict is, then we also expand our imagination of what peace can be. And I think when we have things like climate change or the climate crisis that we all don't know what's coming, I think it kind of humanizes and allows us to act more as a collective. And I think that's what's exciting about it. And I feel like it would be a super missed opportunity if we just stayed in our very linear small boxes of what conflict is and what it isn't.
I mean, for me, and there's been a couple of podcast episodes we've touched on gender and climate a bit as well, and sort of surviving, thriving, whatever, in the face of climate change. I mean, it is a holistic effort. It's not just scientists in a tower somewhere doing something. It's like, no, it starts with people, and it starts with people living different kinds of lives. So just thinking then about positionality and coming back to that, right? So we can all hold different positions in our lives. One of the really key intersectional critiques in feminism is that white women can both be privileged in terms of being white, but then disadvantaged by being a woman, as black men can be privileged by being men, but disadvantaged by being black in, you know, structures of oppression. And it makes me wonder about your position in Myanmar, because you've said you identify as a woman of color in academia, but you're also not from Myanmar. So I'm wondering, like, how you sort of navigated these identities, and what has it meant, and how has it influenced your work there?
Amazing question. Something I've grappled with for a really long time. And yeah, that was a huge part of my research process. And I think I wrote like a 4-page thing about it in my dissertation in the end. It did not need to be that long, but clearly I was like working through it. It was really interesting because I was wearing lots of hats and I felt like I was filling different roles and I just had to navigate all of them. So the first was being not only a critical researcher, a PhD student trying to get access to interviews, so high-level government actors or the key representatives from armed ethnic organizations, as they were called, so the negotiators, and then also working with civil society organizations, and then working also at the same time as a consultant, working with the same actors in a different hat. So questions about access were really important and keeping that really separate, making sure that the information I was finding out from my practice work and was privy to was not translating into my research. So that was really important. That was also doable, right? There's mechanisms, there's ways that you can design a process. What was harder was dealing with that inner feeling of the insider-outsider dynamic. You know, I'm of Asian heritage and I look, actually to a lot of my colleagues, I look really Burmese. I ended up living in Myanmar for 2 years. First in the de facto capital of Yangon, so not the official capital, but the de facto one. And then in the southeast in a beautiful city called Malamyine, which was located in Mon State and one of the ethnic nationalities there. And a lot of colleagues there thought I looked Mon or Shan and would call me Amma, which means sister. But then even if I would say I was from the Philippines, then I would also be called a sister somehow. And then there's that other piece. I also introduced myself as being from the Philippines and then later Canada and then later Switzerland. So I had these multiple identities and it was interesting. I realized after how I use them to create trust and also for myself to feel safer. Also growing up as a minority in a lot of spaces. I've grown up in North America and I live in Europe. I'm in a minority in a lot of these communities. And so navigating that was interesting. And then there's what I'll never forget this. It was my first time in Yangon and I was sort of the assistant to a training that was happening with women peace builders. And I was gifted with tamain, which is a Myanmar or a Burmese sort of longji or sarong in a lot of cultures in Southeast Asia. And then everyone was speaking to me in Burmese or thought I was the interpreter. And so when I would say, like, I'm just wearing this to Maine, and they're like, okay. So I actually actively did not wear this anymore, especially in interviews. I was gifted a lot because it's a beautiful gift and I have a lot. But yeah, it was this thing that I realized I couldn't, it wasn't authentic of me to present as Burmese, even though I think for other people who maybe identify differently, it's clearly a gift or something else. Very nuanced things to what I was wearing, to how I introduced myself, to how I oriented myself. I'm now trying actively to only design research projects in the Philippines or in Turtle Island. And even if I go to the Philippines, I would still, you know, I left the country, my family left for different reasons. The political situation at the time in the 80s under the Marcos regime, I what is being a Filipina and being a Filipina researcher in there? So I am super Filipina if I'm in the diaspora community in Vancouver, but then am I also then in the Philippines where I have a passive fluency in Tagalog, but then wouldn't be able to speak and conduct interviews in Tagalog, much less my mother's dialect of Ilonggo. So I think there's a lot there. Again, I think this is great that we're focusing on identities, positionalities. It is not disconnected. It is all connected. And I will die on this hill because I think that's also
really dying. I can't have guests dying on the podcast.
Yeah, let's not talk about dying on the podcast, but I will defend this, that it's also, for me, it's a feminist view of things, of really just keeping everything connected and having all of those threads as we move through the world, or at least if I move through the world, and what I strive to as a researcher.
Absolutely. And I mean, without being careful, people are going to be like, wow, they're really talking about positions for a long time. But it's also something that I can really relate to, honestly. I mean, because I identify as an immigrant, like here in Spain, more broadly for Europe as well. And there's that idea, especially when you travel a lot and you live in different countries, like you can never really go home again because you're different. And so, I mean, I still don't do research on Australia, where I'm originally from, because it still feels too close. And I feel, honestly, like really ashamed of some of the politics that go on there. So it's a bit too close to home. But at the same time, a lot of my PhD research was on Brexit as a case study. And I found the UK very approachable. I've lived there as well. I had a full, what I would consider, colonial education in Australia. I had almost entirely British school teachers. And so it was that kind of insider-outsider experience that you talked about, where I can completely understand this culture. I can write about it, but it's also, it's not me. Like, yeah. And the difference, I mean, to be fair, as an Australian in the UK, you get a lot of classes and a lot of things. Like, yeah. We're allowed to be convicts, so that's very nice. And, you know, having lived in Russia and in Belgium as well, I've had that insider-outsider experience. Yeah. And it's at this point, it's like, well, I don't have just one identity. I've been all of these places. I've lived different lives. And so it does make things, because you're always going to be a little bit of an outsider.
Yeah.
Yeah. For and sure. That makes it really an interesting dynamic, whether it's research or whether it's just living your life. It's like, well, I'm an immigrant and, you know, you own that.
And I think it's also a beautiful perspective. A lot of my thoughts and reflections are coming from this angle of like, right? Research your own community, mediate in your own community. And that's something that I'm striving towards. But it's also important to have outsider perspectives. And I think for me, it's just, and I'm learning every day. And sometimes I think I do get a bit hypersensitive, maybe paralysis by analysis, or I don't know this phrase, but it's...
You've done a PhD, therefore you are neurotic. I'm sorry. There's no way to get away from it. That's the rule.
Thank you for naming that. I wanted to say that. I completely agree.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's a point. And again, it's not saying, hey, I can't research a case or a context that I literally didn't grow up in. No, there's also no point to that. I think we all have a lot to learn from each other. But yeah, that's what I'm striving to. And it's helped a lot with the ick.
Back to the ick. I was hoping we'd get there. Awesome. Okay, and so what's next for you? What's next in your research?
Yeah, so there's a
or few... in your life as well. That's also yeah. You're not just a researcher. We have multiple identities, as we've established.
Absolutely. So I just joined the Center for Security Studies at ETH Zurich as a senior researcher as part of their mediation team. So still working in the world of mediation. And we have a really exciting book project that we're developing on mediation process design. And so there's this idea that's in many mediation circles of this elusive concept of process design, which is you have your mediation process, and then what are the core elements of your strategy, your structure, your style, you as a mediator, how you design the process essentially. But within that, it's this idea of all of these sort of structural factors, timing, communication skills, the sort of nuts and bolts. But then there's also bigger, more philosophical questions of can a process actually be designed, or is it a series of strategic reactions to what's happening in our field of the conflict context. So it's really exciting. And I think there's a lot of different views that I'm going to bring in from my past research into this space, because I think there's a tendency for thinking of process design in a very linear fashion, sequencing. So we're going to make a big old mess of it. Yeah. And then come out with some concepts that can ideally help mediation practitioners and scholars. So that's what's next. And then I'm working on a few other really exciting book projects. One of them is a book on the apocalypse. And
which one? What are we doing? What genre?
And that's the core question, Laura. You got it. Because with my co-editor, Samantha Marie Gummins, we're coming together with an edited volume on how apocalyptic imaginary, so the climate crisis, destruction, death, and war are often framed in media and film and the news cycle as apocalyptic narratives. You know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, it's apocalyptic. Yeah. Okay.
Well, again, now I want to know, right? Like, what is the equivalent of four horsemen apocalypse from other places?
That's exactly what our book is trying to get at. So
very cool.
It's cool. Yeah. So the whole book is like peace building is an apocalyptic sort of juncture, a critical juncture where we got to figure out where we're going because the problems are of this magnitude. What do we want to bring with us? What do we want? What do we want to leave behind? How can we rebirth the field? And it's, again, this idea of problematizing. What do we think of when we think of apocalypse? It's the four horsemen. There's the Whore of Babylon, but it's also very Judeo-Christian as I learned a big word. It's a real big word, but I learned it for this project. It's called eschatology, and it's the field of study that has to do with the end of the world and judgment day.
It's so cool.
It's so cool.
It's like the name of a dinosaur, honestly.
It's amazing. Yeah. So we have a lot of incredible authors that we're bringing together to talk about other ways about thinking the apocalypse. So whether from Hinduism or from Buddhism, from indigenous cosmology. And what we're finding is that a lot of them are circular, right? Something that's not an end. The apocalypse is not the end of the world, as we seem to think. It's a cycle, and it's the opportunity for rebirth. So that's what the book is about. So there's two things. I have two very, very extreme research interests. One is really how are we making our field as it is, moving it forward, process design, working with things and concepts we know. And then the other is like, how can I get weird? And still make the field really amazing and just expand the imagination. So that really, really motivates me as a researcher. Yeah.
That is so cool. I love this. And so you wrote in your email, as far as what we're talking about today, ... and witches, ? And yeah, I'm really interested in what you meant by that, because I've seen sort of a revival of witch imagery and discourse in the last few years in connection, particularly with feminism and other ways of being. Is that where you're coming from? Or is it like a fashion choice or what? Like, tell me, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, it could also be. Yes, it's exactly that. So you touched on it for sure. So I think as a connection to this book on the apocalypse and peace building, one of the themes that we were exploring is this idea of the image of the witch. And what's been not counted as a conflict and peace building, also historically, when we think about witch trials, and especially in Europe, and I know that there's a different history in Salem and in the United States, part of Turtle Island, but yeah, it's just, I love this notion, I love this feminist reclamation of it, but also understanding that witch hunting is also very much going on in cultures today in different parts of Africa, different parts of the world. But I think the image that I have as somebody that was raised in North America on Hocus Pocus and other things.
Charmed. Yeah. I was all about Charmed.
Charmed. And there's incredible literature that's coming out, feminist literature. There's a great book called Waking the Witch by Pam Grossman. And I think that in this day of age of this idea of communities of women and women that are reclaiming and redefining roles of motherhood and care of healers, and then also kind of understanding this history of misogyny, basically. It wasn't that it was just people identifying as women that were put on the trials, but it was really targeted. And if you go down the rabbit hole of witches and podcasts and understanding how they came to be, there's so many touch points for me about communities that are divided by a traumatic event or experience and then needing to find a scapegoat. And then those scapegoats then often being economically oppressed or at the time in
women over 40,
male in authority that didn't fit societal norms. Like there's so much there, especially when we look at our societies in so much division, so much polarization, so much scapegoating, so much blaming communities, fear and mistrust. There's so much that as people interested in mediating societal conflict, we can use as an imaginary, as an image. And then there's also feminist layers there. There's layers of what was actually seen as witchcraft. A lot of them were indigenous ways of healing for some communities or just communal ways of healing, midwifery, women in science.
Yeah.
There's so much. And so I think, you know, there's a lot. So that's a future research dream. But if I could just write on stuff that I would love to write about and then also make the field I work in better, that's like the goal.
It's very cool. But, you know, as you mentioned Salem, I sort of had to laugh a little bit to myself because it was a dramatic foreshadowing for my life in that it was my year 10 or my year 12 English project, right? I wrote it on the Crucible. And what I researched was the tension between individual freedom and societal oppression in the witch trials. And that's a lot of what it comes down to in terms of these competing norms. And like, it was dramatic foreshadowing to me then going to political science and continuing going on this tension between like absolutely individual society and how do we move forward? So,
but when you think about, I think that's brilliant because when you think about peace building, people that are peace building are at the edge. They're breaking out of those norms. They're breaking out of narratives. And then often they are demonized or vilified or ostracized.
And then we get onto my PhD research, which is all about blame and how we use it to create villains.
There you go.
It's all one big project. I didn't know it at the time. But yeah, absolutely wild. Anyway, so for those who are interested in these fascinating areas of research you're doing and are interested in learning more about your work, where can they find you?
Yes, thank you. So I do have a website. So juliapalmianofederer.com. So there you can look at my publications, the projects I'm working on, different podcasts. My new book, NGOs Mediating Peace, Promoting Inclusion in Myanmar's Nationwide Ceasefire Negotiations, has been published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it's open access, which was something that was really important to me and a big achievement I'm really proud of. So it's available for download on the Springer website. And The Power to Protect is available on the Ottawa Dialogue website. And you can find out more on my website or the CSS ETH Zurich website as well.
And I will include links to all of that in the podcast description. So people can track you down and then ask you about witches or apocalypse or decolonialism, like anything. You're out there for all it all.
I'm out there for everything.
Well, look, thank you so much again for joining me today, Julia. And for everyone else, until next time, this is Laura May with the Conflict Tipping Podcast from Mediate.com.
This podcast has been brought to you by Mediate.com. For more information about Mediate.com products and services, please visit us at www.mediate.com.